You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Chet Chris, London, UK. The Triumphs of Eugene Valmont by Robert Barr. Chapter 2. The Siamese Twin of a Bomb Thrower. Part 2. Next morning I was in Paris, and next night I attended the underground meeting of the anarchists, held within a quarter of a mile of the Luxembourg. I was known to many there assembled, but my acquaintance, of course, was not so large as with the London circle. They had half expected me the night before, knowing that even going by the Hook of Holland I might have reached Paris in time for the conclave. I was introduced generally to the assemblage as the emissary from England, who was to assist the bomb-throwing brother to escape either to that country or to such other point of safety as I might choose. No questions were asked me regarding my doings of the day before, nor was I required to divulge the plans for my fellow members' escape. I was responsible. That was enough. If I failed through no fault of my own, it was but part of the ill luck we were all prepared to face. If I failed through treachery, then a dagger in the back at the earliest possible moment. We all knew the conditions of our sinister contract, and we all recognised that the least said the better. The cellar was dimly lighted by one oil lamp depending from the ceiling. From this hung a cord attached to an extinguisher, and one jerk of the cord would put out the light. Then, while the main entry doors were being battered down by police, the occupants of the room escaped through one of three or four human rat-holes provided for that purpose. If any Parisian anarchist does me the honour to read these jottings, I beg to inform him that while I remained in office under the government of France, there was never a time when I did not know the exit of each of these underground passages, and could during any night there was conference have bagged the whole lot of those there assembled. It was never my purpose, however, to shake the anarchists' confidence in their system, for that merely meant the removal of the gathering to another spot, thus giving us the additional trouble of mapping out their new exits and entrances. When I did make a raid on anarchist headquarters in Paris, it was always to secure some particular man. I had my emissaries in plain clothes stationed at each exit. In any case, the rats were allowed to escape unmolested, sneaking forth with great caution into the night, but we always spotted the man we wanted, and almost invariably arrested him elsewhere, having followed him from his kennel. In each case, my uniformed officers found a dark and empty cellar, and retired apparently baffled. but the coincidence that on the night of every raid some member there present was secretly arrested in another quarter of Paris, and perhaps given a free passage to Russia, never seemed to awaken suspicion in the minds of the conspirators. I think the London anarchist's method is much better, and I have ever considered the English nihilist the most dangerous of this fraternity, for he is cool-headed and not carried away by his own enthusiasm, and consequently rarely carried away by his own police. The authorities of London meet no opposition in making a raid. They find a well-lighted room containing a more or less shabby coterie playing cards at cheap pine tables. There is no money visible, and indeed very little coin would be brought to light if the whole party were searched, so the police are unable to convict the players under the Gambling Act. Besides, it is difficult in any case to obtain a conviction under the Gambling Act, because the accused has the sympathy of the whole country with him. It has always been to me one of the anomalies of the English nature that a magistrate can keep a straight face while he fines some poor wretch for gambling, knowing that next race day, if the court is not sitting, the magistrate himself, in correct sporting costume, with binoculars hanging at his hip, will be on the lawn by the course backing his favourite horse. After my reception at the Anarchist Club of Paris, I remained seated unobtrusively on a bench waiting until routine business was finished, after which I expected an introduction to the man selected to throw the bomb. I am a very sensitive person, and sitting there quietly I became aware that I was being scrutinised with more than ordinary intensity by someone, which gave me a feeling of uneasiness. At last, in the semi-obscurity opposite me, I saw a pair of eyes as luminous as those of a tiger peering fixedly at me. I returned the stare with such composure as I could bring to my aid, and the man, as if fascinated by a look as steady as his own, leaned forward and came more and more into the circle of light. Then I received a shock which it required my utmost self-control to conceal. The face, haggard and drawn, was none other than that of Adolf Simard, who had been my second assistant in the Secret Service of France during my last year in office. He was a most capable and rising young man at that time, and of course he knew me well. Had he then penetrated my disguise? Such an event seemed impossible. He could not have recognised my voice, for I had said nothing aloud since entering the room, my few words to the President being spoken in a whisper. Simard's presence there bewildered me. By this time he should be high up in the Secret Service. If he were now a spy, he would, of course, wish to familiarise himself with every particular of my appearance, as in my hands lay the escape of the criminal. Yet, if such were his mission, why did he attract the attention of all members by this open-eyed scrutiny? That he recognised me as Valmont, I had not the least fear. My disguise was too perfect. And, even if I were there in my own proper person, I had not seen Simard nor he me for 10 years, and great changes occur in a man's appearance during so long a period. Yet I remembered with disquietude that Mr. White recognised me, and here tonight I had recognised Simard. I could not move my bench farther back, because it stood already against the wall. Simard, on the contrary, was seated on one of the few chairs in the room, and this he periodically hitched forward, the better to continue his examination, which now attracted the notice of others besides myself. As he came forward, I could not help admiring the completeness of his disguise so far as apparel was concerned. He was a perfect picture of the Paris wastrel, and what was more, he wore on his head a cap of the Apaches, the most dangerous band of cutthroats that have ever cursed a civilised city. I could understand that even among lawless anarchists, this badge of membership of the Apache band might well strike terror. I felt that before the meeting adjourned I must speak with him, and I determined to begin our conversation by asking him why he stared so fixedly at me. Yet even then I should have made little progress. I did not dare to hint that he belonged to the Secret Service. Nevertheless, if the authorities had this plot in charge, it was absolutely necessary we should work together, or at least that I should know they were in the secret, and steer my course accordingly. The fact that Simard appeared with undisguised face was not so important as might appear to an outsider. It is always safer for a spy to preserve his natural appearance if that is possible, because a false beard or false moustache or wig run the risk of being deranged or torn away. As I have said, an anarchist assemblage is simply a room filled with the atmosphere of suspicion. I have known instances where an innocent stranger was suddenly set upon in the midst of solemn proceedings by two or three impetuous fellow members, who nearly jerked his own whiskers from his face under the impression that they were false. If Simard therefore appeared in his own scraggy beard and unkempt hair, it meant that he communicated with headquarters by some circuitous route. I realised, therefore, that a very touchy bit of diplomacy awaited me, if I was to learn from himself his actual status. While I pondered over this perplexity, it was suddenly dissolved by the action of the President, and another substituted for it. "Will Brother Simard come forward?" asked the President. My former subordinate removed his eyes from me, slowly rose from his chair, and shuffled up to the President's table. "Brother Ducharme," said that official to me in a quiet tone, "I introduce you to Brother Simard, whom you are commissioned to see into a place of safety when he has dispersed the procession." Simard turned his fishy goggle eyes upon me, and a grin disclosed wolf-like teeth. He held out his hand, which, rising to my feet, I took. He gave me a flabby grasp, and all the time his inquiring eyes travelled over me. "You don't look up to much," he said. "What are you?" "I am a teacher of the French language in London." "Hm," growled Simard, evidently in no wise prepossessed by my appearance. "I thought you weren't much of a fighter. The gendarmes will make short work of this fellow," he growled to the chairman. "Brother Ducharme is vouched for by the whole English circle," replied the President firmly. "Oh, the English! I think very little of them. Still, it doesn't matter." And with a shrug of the shoulders, he shuffled to his seat again, leaving me standing there in a very embarrassed state of mind, my brain in a whirl. That the man was present with his own face was bewildering enough, but that he should be here under his own name was simply astounding. I scarcely heard what the President said. It seemed to the effect that Simard would take me to his own room, where we might talk over our plans. And now Simard rose again from his chair and said to the President that if nothing more were wanted of him, we should go. Accordingly, we left the place of meeting together. I watched my comrade narrowly. There was now a trembling eagerness in his action, and without a word he hurried me to the nearest café, where we sat down before a little iron table on the pavement. "Garçon," he shouted harshly, "bring me 4 absinthes." "What will you drink, Ducharme?" "A café cognac, if you please." "Bah!" cried Simard. "Better have absinthe." Then he cursed the waiter for his slowness. When the absinthe came, he grasped the half-full glass and swallowed the liquid raw, a thing I have never seen done before. Into the next measure of the wormwood he poured the water impetuously from the carafe, another thing I had never seen done before, and dropped 2 lumps of sugar into it. Over the 3rd glass he placed a flat, perforated, plated spoon, piled the sugar on this bridge, and now quite expertly allowed the water to drip through, the proper way of concocting this seductive mixture. Finishing his 2nd glass, he placed the perforated spoon over the 4th, and began now more calmly sipping the 3rd, while the water dripped slowly into the last glass. Here, before my eyes, was enacted a more wonderful change than the gradual transformation of transparent absinthe into an opaque, opalescent liquid. Simard, under the influence of the drink, was slowly becoming the Simard I had known 10 years before. Remarkable! Absinthe, having in earlier years made a beast of the man, was now forming a man out of the beast. His staring eyes took on an expression of human comradeship. The whole mystery became perfectly clear to me without a question asked or an answer uttered. This man was no spy, but a genuine anarchist. However it happened, he had become a victim of absinthe. one of many with whom I was acquainted, although I never met any so far sunk as he. He was into his fourth glass and had ordered two more when he began to speak. "Here's to us," he cried, with something like a civilized smile on his gaunt face. "You're not offended by what I said in the meeting, I hope?"
"Oh, no," I answered.
"That's right. You see, I once belonged to the Secret Service, and if my chief was there today, we would soon find ourselves in a cool dungeon. We couldn't trip up Eugene Valmont." At these words, spoken with sincerity, I sat up in my chair, and I am sure such an expression of enjoyment came into my face that, if I had not instantly suppressed it, I might have betrayed myself. "Who was Eugene Valmont?" I asked, in a tone of assumed indifference. Mixing his fifth glass, he nodded sagely. "You wouldn't ask that question if you'd been in Paris a dozen years ago. He was the government's chief detective, and he knew more of anarchists, yes, and of Apaches too, than either you or I do. He had more brains in his little finger than that whole lot babbling there tonight. But the government, being a fool, as all governments are, dismissed him. And because I was his assistant, they dismissed me as well. They got rid of all his staff. Valmont disappeared. If I could have found him, I wouldn't be sitting here with you tonight, but he was right to disappear. The government did all they could against us who had been his friends, and I, for one, came through starvation, and was near throwing myself in the Seine, which sometimes I wish I had done. Here, garçon, another absinthe. But by and by I came to like the gutter, and here I am. I'd rather have the gutter and absinthe than the Luxembourg without it. I've had my revenge on the government many times since, for I knew their ways, and often have I circumvented the police. That's why they respect me among the anarchists. Do you know how I joined? I knew all their passwords, and walked right into one of their meetings, alone and in rags. "Here am I said, "Adolphe Simard, late second assistant to Eugene Valmont, chief detective to the French government." There were 20 weapons covering me at once, but I laughed. "I'm starving," I cried, "and I want something to eat, and more especially something to drink. In return for that, I'll show you every rat hole you've got. Lift the president's chair, and there's a trap door that leads to the Rue Blanc. I'm one of you, and I'll tell you the tricks of the police." Such was my initiation, and from that moment the police began to pick their spies out of the Seine. And now they leave us alone. Even Valmont himself could do nothing against the anarchists since I have joined them. Oh, the incredible self-conceit of human nature! Here was this ruffian proclaiming the limitations of Valmont, who half an hour before had shaken his hand within the innermost circle of his order. Yet my heart warmed toward the wretch who had remembered me and my exploits. It now became my anxious and difficult task to lure Simard away from this café and its absinthe. Glass after glass of the poison had brought him up almost to his former intellectual level, but now it was shoving him rapidly down the hill again. I must know where his room was situated, yet if I waited much longer the man would be in a state of drunken imbecility which would not only render it impossible for him to guide me to his room, but likely caused both of us to be arrested by the police. I tried persuasion, and he laughed at me. I tried threats, whereat he scowled and cursed me as a renegade from England. At last the liquor overpowered him, and his head sunk on the metal table and the dark blue cap fell to the floor. I was in despair, but now received a lesson which taught me that if a man leaves a city even for a short time, he falls out of touch with its ways. I called the waiter and said to him, "Do you know my friend here?"
"I do not know his name," replied the garçon, "but I have seen him many times at this café. He is usually in this state when he has money."
"Do you know where he lives? He promised to take me with him, and I am a stranger in Paris."
"Have no discontent, monsieur. Rest tranquil. I will intervene."
With this, he stepped across the pavement in front of the café, into the street, and gave utterance to a low, peculiar whistle. The café was now nearly deserted, for the hour was very late, or rather very early. When the waiter returned, I whispered to him in some anxiety, "Not the police, surely?" "But no," he cried in scorn, "certainly not the police." He went on unconcernedly taking in the empty chairs and tables. A few minutes later, there swaggered up to the table two of the most disreputable, low-browed scoundrels I have ever seen, each wearing a dark blue cap, with a glazed peak over the eyes, caps exactly similar to the one which lay in front of Simard. The band of Apaches which now permeates all Paris had risen since my time, and Simard had been mistaken an hour before in asserting that Valmont was familiar with their haunts. The present chief of police in Paris and some of his predecessors confess there is a difficulty in dealing with these picked assassins, but I should very much like to take a hand in the game on the side of law and order. However, that is not to be, therefore the Apaches increase and prosper. The two vagabonds roughly smote Simard's cap on his prone head, and as roughly raised him to his feet. "He is a friend of mine," I interposed, "and promised to take me home with him." "Good, follow us," said one of them. And now I passed through the morning streets of Paris behind three cutthroats, yet knew that I was safer than if broad daylight was in the thoroughfare, with a meridian sun shining down upon us. I was doubly safe, being in no fear of harm from midnight prowlers, and equally free from danger of arrest by the police. Every officer we met avoided us, and casually stepped to the other side of the street. We turned down a narrow lane, then through a still narrower one which terminated at a courtyard. Entering a tall building, we climbed up five flights of stairs to a landing, where one of the scouts kicked open a door, into a room so miserable that there was not even a lock to protect its poverty. Here they allowed the insensible Simard to drop with a crash on the floor. Thus they left us alone without even an adieu. The Apaches take care of their own after a fashion. I struck a match, and found part of a bougie stuck in the mouth of an absinthe bottle, resting on a rough deal table. Lighting the bougie, I surveyed this horrible apartment. A heap of rags lay in a corner, and this was evidently Simard's bed. I hauled him to it, and there he lay unconscious, himself a bundle of rags. I found one chair, or rather, stool, for it had no back. I drew the table against the lockless door, blew out the light, sat on the stool, resting my arms on the table and my head on my arms, and slept peacefully till long after daybreak. Simard awoke in the worst possible humour. He poured forth a great variety of abusive epithets at me. To make himself still more agreeable, he turned back the rags on which he had slept and brought to the light a round black object, like a small cannon ball, which he informed me was the picric bomb that was to scatter destruction among my English friends, for whom he expressed the greatest possible loathing and contempt. Then, sitting up, he began playing with this infernal machine, knowing as well as I that if he allowed it to drop, that was the end of us two. I shrugged my shoulders at this display, and affected a nonchalance I was far from feeling, but finally put an end to his dangerous amusement by telling him that if he came out with me, I would pay for his breakfast and give him a drink of absinthe. The next few days were the most anxious of my life. Never before had I lived on terms of intimacy with a picric bomb, that most deadly and uncertain of all explosive agencies. I speedily found that Simard was so absinthe-soaked I could do nothing with him. He could not be bribed, or cajoled, or persuaded, or threatened. Once, indeed, when he talked with drunken affection of Eugene Valmont, I conceived a wild notion of declaring myself to him, but a moment's reflection showed the absolute uselessness of this course. It was not one Simard with whom I had to deal, but half a dozen or more. There was Simard, sober, half-sober, quarter-sober, drunk, half-drunk, quarter-drunk, or wholly drunk.
any bargain I might make with the one Simard would not be kept by any of the other six. The only safe Simard was Simard insensible through overindulgence. I had resolved to get Simard insensibly drunk on the morning of the procession, but my plans were upset at a meeting of the anarchists, which luckily took place on an evening shortly after my arrival, and this gave me time to mature the plan which was actually carried out. Each member of the anarchist club knew of Simard's slavery to absinthe, and fears were expressed that he might prove incapable on the day of the procession, too late for a substitute to take his place. It was therefore proposed that one or two others should be stationed along the route of the procession with bombs ready if Simard failed. This I strenuously opposed, and guaranteed that Simard would be ready to launch his missile. I met with little difficulty in persuading the company to agree, because, after all, every man among them feared he might be one of those selected, which choice was practically a sentence of death. I guaranteed that the bomb would be thrown, and this apparently was taken to mean that if Simard did not do the deed, I would. This danger over, I next took the measurements and estimated the weight of the Picric bomb. I then sought out a most amiable and expert pyrotechnist, a capable workman of genius, who with his own hand makes those dramatic firework arrangements which you sometimes see in Paris. As Eugène Valmont, I had rendered a great service to this man, and he was not likely to have forgotten it. During one of the anarchist scares, a stupid policeman had arrested him, and when I intervened, the man was just on the verge of being committed for life. France trembled in one of her panics, or rather, Paris did, and demanded victims. This blameless little workman had indeed contributed with both material and advice, but any fool might have seen that he had done this innocently. His assistance had been invoked and secured under the pretense that his clients were promoting an amateur firework display, which was true enough, but the display cost the lives of three men, and intentionally so. I cheered up the citizen in the moment of his utmost despair, and brought such proof of his innocence to the knowledge of those above me that he was most reluctantly acquitted. To this man I now went with my measurement of the bomb and the estimate of its weight. "Sir," said I, "do you remember Eugène Valmont?" "Am I ever likely to forget him?" he replied with a fervour that pleased me. "He has sent me to you, and implores you to aid me, and that aid will wipe out the debt you owe him." "Willingly, willingly," cried the artisan, "so long as it has nothing to do with the anarchists or the making of bombs." "It has to do exactly with those two things. I wish you to make an innocent bomb which will prevent an anarchist outrage." At this the little man drew back, and his face became pale. "It is impossible," he protested. "I have had enough of innocent bombs. No, no. And in any case, how can I be sure you come from Eugène Valmont?" "No, monsieur, I am not to be trapped the second time." At this I related rapidly all that Valmont had done for him, and even repeated Valmont's most intimate conversation with him. The man was nonplussed, but remained firm. "I dare not do it," he said. We were alone in his back shop. I walked to the door and thrust in the bolt, then after a moment's pause turned round, stretched forth my right hand dramatically, and cried, "Behold, Eugène Valmont!" My friend staggered against the wall in his amazement, and I continued in solemn tones, "Eugène Valmont, who by this removal of his disguise places his life in your hands, as your life was in his. Now, monsieur, what will you do?" He replied, "Monsieur Valmont, I shall do whatever you ask. If I refused a moment ago, it was because I thought there was now in France no Eugène Valmont to rectify my mistake if I made one." I resumed my disguise, and told him I wished an innocent substitute for this Picric bomb, and he at once suggested an earthenware globe, which would weigh the same as the bomb, and which could be coloured to resemble it exactly. "And now, Monsieur Valmont, do you wish smoke to issue from this imitation bomb?" "Yes," I said, "in such quantity as you can compress within it." "It is easily done," he cried, with the enthusiasm of a true French artist. "And may I place within some little design of my own which will astonish your friends the English and delight my friends the French?"
"Monsieur," said I am in your hands. I trust the project entirely to your skill."
And thus it came about that 4 days later I substituted the bogus globe for the real one, and, unseen, dropped the Pickwick bomb from one of the bridges into the Seine. On the morning of the procession I was compelled to allow Simard several drinks of absinthe to bring him up to a point where he could be depended on. Otherwise his anxiety and determination to fling the bomb, his frenzy against all government, made it certain that he would betray both of us before the fateful moment came. My only fear was that I could not stop him drinking when once he began. But somehow our days of close companionship, loathsome as they were to me, seemed to have had the effect of building up again the influence I held over him in former days, and his yielding more or less to my wishes appeared to be quite unconscious on his part. The procession was composed entirely of carriages, each containing 4 persons. 2 Englishmen sat on the back seats, with 2 Frenchmen in front of them. A thick crowd lined each side of the thoroughfare, cheering vociferously. Right into the middle of the procession Simard launched his bomb. There was no crash of explosion. The missile simply went to pieces as if it were an earthenware jar, and there arose a dense column of very white smoke. In the immediate vicinity the cheering stopped at once, and the sinister word "bomb" passed from lip to lip in awed whispers. As the throwing had been unnoticed in the midst of the commotion, I held Simard firmly by the wrist, determined that he should not draw attention to himself by his panic-stricken desire for immediate flight. "Stand still, you fool," I hissed into his ear, and he obeyed, trembling. The pair of horses in front of which the bomb fell rose for a moment on their hind legs and showed signs of bolting, but the coachman held them firmly and uplifted his hand so that the procession behind him came to a momentary pause. No one in the carriages moved a muscle. Then suddenly the tension was broken by a great and simultaneous cheer. Wondering at this, I turned my eyes from the frightened horses to the column of pale smoke in front of us, and saw that in some manner it had resolved itself into a gigantic calla lily, pure white, while from the base of this sprung the lilies of France, delicately tinted. Of course this could not have happened if there had been the least wind, but the air was so still that the vibration of the cheering caused the huge lily to tremble gently as it stood there marvellously poised, the lily of peace, surrounded by the lilies of France. That was the design, and if you ask me how it was done, I can only refer you to my pyrotechnist, and say that whatever a Frenchman attempts to do, he will accomplish artistically. And now these imperturbable English, who had been seated immobile when they thought a bomb was thrown, stood up in their carriages to get a better view of this aerial phenomenon, cheering and waving their hats. The lily gradually thinned and dissolved in little patches of cloud that floated away above our heads. "I cannot stay here longer," groaned Simard, quaking, his nerves, like himself, in rags. "I see the ghosts of those I have killed floating around me." "Come on, then, but do not hurry." There was no difficulty in getting him to London, but it was absinthe, absinthe, all the way, and when we reached Charing Cross I was compelled to help him, partly insensible, into a cab. I took him direct to Imperial Flats, and up into my own set of chambers, where I opened my strong-room and flung him inside to sleep off his intoxication, and subsist on bread and water when he became sober. I attended that night a meeting of the anarchists, and detailed accurately the story of our escape from France. I knew we had been watched, and so skipped no detail. I reported that I had taken Simard directly to my compatriot's flat, to Eugene Valmont, the man who had given me employment, and who had promised to do what he could for Simard, beginning by trying to break him of the absinthe habit, as he was now a physical wreck through overindulgence in that stimulant. It was curious to note the discussion which took place a few nights afterwards regarding the failure of the Pickwick bomb.
Scientists among us said that the bomb had been made too long, that a chemical reaction had taken place which destroyed its power. A few superstitious ones saw a miracle in what had happened, and they forthwith left our organization. Then again, things were made easier by the fact that the man who constructed the bomb, evidently terror-stricken at what he had done, disappeared the day before the procession and has never since been heard of. The majority of the anarchists believed he had made a bogus bomb and had fled to escape their vengeance rather than to evade the justice of the law. Simard will need no purgatory in the next world. I kept him on bread and water for a month in my strong-room, and at first he demanded absinthe with threats, then grovelled, begging and praying for it. After that a period of depression and despair ensued, but finally his naturally strong constitution conquered, and began to build itself up again. I took him from his prison one midnight and gave him a bed in my Soho room, taking care in bringing him away that he would never recognize the place where he had been incarcerated. In my dealings with him, I had always been that old man, Paul Ducharme. Next morning I said to him, "You spoke of Eugène Valmont. I have learned that he lives in London, and I advise you to call upon him. Perhaps he can get you something to do." Simard was overjoyed, and 2 hours later, as Eugène Valmont, I received him in my flat and made him my assistant on the spot. From that time forward, Paul Ducharme, language teacher, disappeared from the earth, and Simard abandoned his two A's, anarchy and absinthe. End of chapter 2. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Chekris, London, UK. The Triumphs of Eugène Valmont by Robert Barr. Chapter 3. The Clue of the Silver Spoons. When the card was brought in to me, I looked upon it with some misgiving, for I scented a commercial transaction, and although such cases are lucrative enough, nevertheless I, Eugène Valmont, formerly high in the service of the French government, do not care to be connected with them. They usually pertain to sordid business affairs, presenting little that is of interest to a man who, in his time, has dealt with subtle questions of diplomacy upon which the welfare of nations sometimes turned. The name of Bentham Gibbs is familiar to everyone, connected as it is with the much-advertised pickles, whose glaring announcements in crude crimson and green strike the eye throughout Great Britain, and shock the artistic sense wherever seen. Me, I have never tasted them, and shall not so long as a French restaurant remains open in London. But I doubt not they are as pronounced to the palate as their advertisement is distressing to the eye. If, then, this gross pickle manufacturer expected me to track down those who were infringing upon the recipes for making his so-called sauces, chutneys, and the like, he would find himself mistaken, for I was now in a position to pick and choose my cases, and a case of pickles did not allure me. "Beware of imitations," said the advertisement. "None genuine without a facsimile of the signature of Bentham Gibbs." Ah, well, not for me were either the pickles or the tracking of imitators. A forged cheque, yes, if you like, but the forged signature of Mr. Gibbs on a pickle bottle was out of my line. Nevertheless, I said to Armand, "Show the gentleman in," and he did so. To my astonishment, there entered a young man, quite correctly dressed in a dark frock-coat, faultless waistcoat, and trousers that proclaimed a Bond Street tailor. When he spoke, his voice and language were those of a gentleman. "Monsieur Valmont?" he inquired. "At your service,"
I replied, bowing and waving my hand as Armand placed a chair for him, and withdrew. "I am a barrister with chambers in the Temple," began Mr. Gibbs, "and for some days a matter has been troubling me about which I have come to seek your advice, your name having been suggested by a friend in whom I confided." "Am I acquainted with him?" I asked. "I think not," replied Mr. Gibbs. "He also is a barrister, with chambers in the same building as my own. Lionel Dacre is his name." "I never heard of him." "Very likely not. Nevertheless, he recommended you as a man who could keep his own counsel, and if you take up this case, I desire the utmost secrecy preserved, whatever may be the outcome." I bowed, but made no protestation. Secrecy is a matter of course with me. The Englishman paused for a few moments as if he expected fervent assurances, then went on with no trace of disappointment on his countenance at not receiving them. "On the night of the 23rd, I gave a little dinner to 6 friends of mine in my own rooms. I may say that so far as I am aware, they are all gentlemen of unimpeachable character. On the night of the dinner, I was detained later than I expected at a reception, and in driving to the Temple was still further delayed by a block of traffic in Piccadilly, so that when I arrived at my chambers there was barely time for me to dress and receive my guests. My man, Johnson, had everything laid out ready for me in my dressing-room, and as I passed through to it, I hurriedly flung off the coat I was wearing and carelessly left it hanging over the back of a chair in the dining-room, where neither Johnson nor myself noticed it, until my attention was called to it after the dinner was over, and everyone rather jolly with wine. This coat contains an inside pocket. Usually any frock coat I wear at an afternoon reception has not an inside pocket, but I had been rather on the rush all day. My father is a manufacturer whose name may be familiar to you, and I am on the directors' board of his company. On this occasion I took a cab from the city to the reception I spoke of, and had not time to go and change at my rooms. The reception was a somewhat bohemian affair, extremely interesting, of course, but not too particular as to costume, so I went as I was. In this inside pocket rested a thin package, composed of 2 pieces of cardboard, and between them rested 5 £20 Bank of England notes, folded lengthwise, held in place by an elastic rubber band. I had thrown the coat across the chair back in such a way that the inside pocket was exposed, leaving the ends of the notes plainly recognisable. Over the coffee and cigars, one of my guests laughingly called attention to what he termed my vulgar display of wealth, and Johnson, in some confusion at having neglected to put away the coat, now picked it up and took it to the reception room where the wraps of my guests lay about promiscuously. He should, of course, have hung it up in my wardrobe, but he said afterwards he thought it belonged to the guest who had spoken. You see, Johnson was in my dressing-room when I threw my coat on the chair in the corner while making my way thither, and I suppose he had not noticed the coat in the hurry of arriving guests, otherwise he would have put it where it belonged. After everybody had gone, Johnson came to me and said the coat was there, but the package was missing, nor has any trace of it been found since that night. The dinner was fetched in from outside, I suppose? Yes. How many waiters served it? 2. They are men who have often been in my employ on similar occasions, but apart from that, they had left my chambers before the incident of the coat happened. Neither of them went into the reception room, I take it. No, I am certain that not even suspicion can attach to either of the waiters. Your man, Johnson, has been with me for years. He could easily have stolen much more than the £100 if he had wished to do so, but I have never known him to take a penny that did not belong to him. Will you favour me with the names of your guests, Mr. Gibbs? Viscount Sterne sat at my right hand, and at my left Lord Templemere. Sir John Sanclair next to him, and Angus McKellar next to Sanclair. After Viscount Sterne was Lionel Dacre, and at his right Vincent Innis. On a sheet of paper I had written the names of the guests, and noted their places at the table. "Which guest drew your attention to the money?"
"Lionel Dacre."
"Is there a window looking out from the reception room?"
"Two of them."
"Were they fastened on the night of the dinner party?"
"I could not be sure.
Very likely Johnson would know." "You are hinting at the possibility of a thief coming in through a reception room window while we were somewhat noisy over our wine. I think such a solution highly improbable. My rooms are on the third floor, and a thief would scarcely venture to make an entrance when he could not but know there was a company being entertained. Besides this, the coat was there less than an hour, and it appears to me that whoever stole those notes knew where they were."
"That seems reasonable," I had to admit.
"Have you spoken to anyone of your loss?"
"To no one but Dacre, who recommended me to see you."
"Oh, yes, and to Johnson, of course." I could not help noting that this was the fourth or fifth time Dacre's name had come up during our conversation.
"What of Dacre?" I asked.
"Oh, well, you see, he occupies chambers in the same building on the ground floor. He's a very good fellow, and we are by way of being firm friends. Then it was he who had called attention to the money, so I thought he should know the sequel."
"How did he take your news?"
"Now that you call attention to the fact, he seemed slightly troubled. I should like to say, however, that you must not be misled by that. Lionel Dacre could no more steal than he could lie."
"Did he show any surprise when you mentioned the theft?"
Bentham Gibbs paused a moment before replying, knitting his brows in thought.
"No," he said at last, "and, come to think of it, it appeared as if he had been expecting my announcement."
"Doesn't that strike you as rather strange, Mr. Gibbs?"
"Really, my mind is in such a whirl I don't know what to think. But it's perfectly absurd to suspect Dacre. If you knew the man, you would understand what I mean. He comes of an excellent family, and he is... oh, he is Lionel Dacre. And when you have said that, you have made any suspicion absurd."
"I suppose you caused the rooms to be thoroughly searched. The packet didn't drop out and remain unnoticed in some corner."
"No, Johnson and myself examined every inch of the premises."
"Have you the numbers of the notes?"
"Yes, I got them from the bank next morning. Payment was stopped, and so far not one of the five has been presented. Of course, one or more may have been cashed at some shop, but none have been offered to any of the banks. A £20 note is not accepted without scrutiny, so the chances are the thief may find some difficulty in disposing of them. As I told you, I don't mind the loss of the money at all. It is the uncertainty, the uneasiness caused by the incident which troubles me. You will comprehend how little I care about the notes when I say that if you are good enough to interest yourself in this case, I shall be disappointed if your fee does not exceed the amount I have lost."
Mr. Gibbs rose as he said this, and I accompanied him to the door, assuring him that I should do my best to solve the mystery. Whether he sprang from pickles or not, I realized he was a polished and generous gentleman, who estimated the services of a professional expert like myself at their true value. I shall not set down the details of my researches during the following few days, because the trend of them must be gone over in the account of that remarkable interview in which I took part somewhat later. Suffice it to say that an examination of the rooms, and a close cross-questioning of Johnson, satisfied me he and the two waiters were innocent. I became certain no thief had made his way through the window, and finally I arrived at the conclusion that the notes were stolen by one of the guests. Further investigation convinced me that the thief was no other than Lionel Dacre, the only one of the six in pressing need of money at this time. I caused Dacre to be shadowed, and during one of his absences made the acquaintance of his man Hopper, a surly, impolite brute, who accepted my golden sovereign quickly enough but gave me little in exchange for it. While I conversed with him, There arrived in the passage where we were talking together a huge case of champagne, bearing one of the best known names in the trade, and branded as being of the vintage of 78. Now I knew that the product of Camelot Frères is not bought as cheaply as British beer, and I also had learned that 2 short weeks before Mr. Lionel Dacre was at his wit's end for money. Yet he was still the same briefless barrister he had ever been. On the morning after my unsatisfactory conversation with his man, Hopper, I was astonished to receive the following note, written on a dainty correspondence card. 3 and 4 Vellum Buildings, Inner Temple, E.C. Mr. Lionel Dacre presents his compliments to Monsieur Eugène Valmont, and would be obliged if Monsieur Valmont could make it convenient to call upon him in his chambers tomorrow morning at 11. Had the young man become aware that he was being shadowed, or had the surly servant informed him of the inquiries made? I was soon to know. I called punctually at 11 next morning, and was received with charming urbanity by Mr. Dacre himself. The taciturn Hopper had evidently been sent away for the occasion. "My dear Monsieur Valmont, I am delighted to meet you," began the young man, with more of effusiveness than I had ever noticed in an Englishman before, although his very next words supplied an explanation that did not occur to me until afterwards as somewhat far-fetched. "I believe we are by way of being countrymen, and therefore, although the hour is early, I hope you will allow me to offer you some of this bottled sunshine of the year 78 from La Belle France, to whose prosperity and honour we shall drink together. For such a toast, any hour is propitious." And to my amazement, he brought forth from the case I had seen arrive 2 days before a bottle of that superb Camelot Frères, 78. "Now," said I to myself, "it is going to be difficult to keep a clear head if the aroma of this nectar rises to the brain. But tempting as is the cup, I shall drink sparingly, and hope he may not be so judicious." Sensitive, I already experienced the charm of his personality, and well understood the friendship Mr. Bentham Gibbs felt for him. But I saw the trap spread before me. He expected, under the influence of champagne and courtesy, to extract a promise from me which I must find myself unable to give. "Sir, you interest me by claiming kinship with France. I had understood that you belonged to one of the oldest families of England." "Ah, England," he cried, with an expressive gesture of outspreading hands truly Parisian in its significance. "The trunk belongs to England, of course, but the root, ah, the root, Monsieur Valmont, penetrated the soil from which this wine of the gods has been drawn." Then, filling my glass and his own, he cried, "To France, which my family left in the year 1066. I could not help laughing at his fervent ejaculation. 1066, with William the Conqueror, that is a long time ago, Mr. Dacre. In years, perhaps. In feelings, but a day. My forefathers came over to steal, and, Lord, how well they accomplished it. They stole the whole country. Something like a theft, say I, under that prince of robbers whom you have well named the Conqueror. In our secret hearts, we all admire a great thief, and if not a great one, then an expert one, who covers his tracks so perfectly that the hounds of justice are baffled in attempting to follow them. Now even you, Monsieur Valmont, I can see you are the most generous of men, with a lively sympathy found to perfection only in France. Even you must suffer a pang of regret when you lay a thief by the heels who has done his task deftly. I fear, Mr. Dacre, you credit me with a magnanimity to which I dare not lay claim. The criminal is a danger to society." "True, true, you are in the right, Monsieur Valmont. Still, admit there are cases that would touch you tenderly. For example, a man, ordinarily honest, a great need, a sudden opportunity. He takes that of which another has abundance, and he nothing. What then, Monsieur Valmont? Is the man to be sent to perdition for a momentary weakness?
His words astonished me. Was I on the verge of hearing a confession? It almost amounted to that already. "Mr. Dacre," I said, "I cannot enter into the subtleties you pursue. My duty is to find the criminal." "Again I say you are in the right, Monsieur Valmont, and I am enchanted to find so sensible a head on French shoulders. Although you are a more recent arrival, if I may say so, than myself, you nevertheless already give utterance to sentiments which do honour to England. It is your duty to hunt down the criminal. Very well. In that I think I can aid you, and thus have taken the liberty of requesting your attendance here this morning. Let me fill your glass again, Monsieur Valmont. No more, I beg of you, Mr. Dacre. What, do you think the receiver is as bad as the thief?" I was so taken aback by this remark that I suppose my face showed the amazement within me. But the young man merely laughed with apparent free-hearted enjoyment, poured some wine into his own glass, and tossed it off. Not knowing what to say, I changed the current of conversation. "Mr. Gibbs said you had been kind enough to recommend me to his attention. May I ask how you came to hear of me?" "Ah, who has not heard of the renowned Monsieur Valmont?" And as he said this, for the first time there began to grow a suspicion in my mind that he was chaffing me, as it is called in England, a procedure which I cannot endure. Indeed, if this gentleman practised such a barbarism in my own country, he would find himself with a duel on his hands before he had gone far. However, the next instant his voice resumed its original fascination, and I listened to it as to some delicious melody. "I need only mention my cousin, Lady Gladys Dacre, and you will at once understand why I recommend you to my friend. The case of Lady Gladys, you will remember, required a delicate touch which is not always to be had in this land of England, except when those who possess the gift do us the honour to sojourn with us." I noticed that my glass was again filled, and bowing an acknowledgement of his compliment, I indulged in another sip of the delicious wine. I sighed, for I began to realise it was going to be very difficult for me, in spite of my disclaimer, to tell this man's friend he had stolen the money. All this time he had been sitting on the edge of the table, while I occupied a chair at its end. He sat there in careless fashion, swinging a foot to and fro. Now he sprang to the floor and drew up a chair, placing on the table a blank sheet of paper. Then he took from the mantel shelf a packet of letters, and I was astonished to see they were held together by two bits of cardboard and a rubber band, similar to the combination that had contained the folded banknotes. With great nonchalance, he slipped off the rubber band, threw it and the pieces of cardboard on the table before me, leaving the documents loose to his hand. "Now, Monsieur Valmont," he cried jauntily, "you have been occupied for several days on this case, the case of my dear friend Bentham Gibbs, who is one of the best fellows in the world." "He said the same of you, Mr. Dacre." "I am gratified to hear it. Would you mind letting me know to what point your researches have led you?"
"They have led me in a direction rather than to a point."
"Ah, in the direction of a man, of course."
"Certainly."
"Who is he?"
"Will you pardon me if I decline to answer this question at the present moment?"
"That means you are not sure."
"It may mean, Mr. Dacre, that I am employed by Mr. Gibbs, and do not feel at liberty to disclose the results of my quest without his permission."
"But Mr. Bentham Gibbs and I are entirely at one in this matter. Perhaps you are aware that I am the only person with whom he has discussed the case, beside yourself."
"That is undoubtedly true, Mr. Dacre. Still, you see the difficulty of my position."
"Yes, I do, and so shall press you no further. But I also have been studying the problem in a purely amateurish way, of course. You will perhaps express no disinclination to learn whether or not my deductions agree with yours."
"None in the least."
"I shall be very glad to know the conclusion at which you have arrived. May I ask if you suspect anyone in particular?"
"Yes, I do."
"Will you name him?"
"No."
"I shall copy the admirable reticence you yourself have shown. And now let us attack this mystery in a sane and businesslike manner. You have already examined the room. Well, here is a rough sketch of it. There is the table. In this corner stood the chair on which the coat was flung. Here sat Gibbs at the head of the table. Those on the left-hand side had their backs to the chair. I, being on the centre to the right, saw the chair, the coat, and the notes, and called attention to them. Now, our first duty is to find a motive. If it were a murder, our motive might be hatred, revenge, robbery, what you like. As it is simply the stealing of money, the man must have been either a born thief, or else some hitherto innocent person pressed to the crime by great necessity. Do you agree with me, Monsieur Valmont? Perfectly. You follow exactly the line of my own reasoning. Very well. It is unlikely that a born thief was one of Mr. Gibbs's guests. Therefore, we are reduced to look for a man under the spur of necessity, a man who has no money of his own, but who must raise a certain amount, let us say, by a certain date. If we can find such a man in that company, do you not agree with me that he is likely to be the thief? Yes, I do. Then let us start our process of elimination. Out goes Viscount Stern, a lucky individual with 20,000 acres of land and God only knows what income. I mark off the name of Lord Templemere, one of His Majesty's judges, entirely above suspicion. Next, Sir John Sanclair. He also is rich, but Vincent Innes is still richer, so the pencil obliterates both names. Now we arrive at Angus McKellar, an author of some note, as you are well aware, deriving a good income from his books and a better one from his plays. A canny Scot, so we may rub his name from our paper and our memory. How do my erasures correspond with yours, Monsieur Valmont? They correspond exactly, Mr. Dacre. I am flattered to hear it. There remains one name untouched, Mr. Lionel Dacre, the descendant, as I have said, of robbers. I have not said so, Mr. Dacre. Ah, my dear Valmont, the politeness of your country asserts itself. Let us not be deluded, but follow our inquiry wherever it leads. I suspect Lionel Dacre. What do you know of his circumstances before the dinner of the 23rd? As I made no reply, he looked up at me with his frank, boyish face illumined by a winning smile. "You know nothing of his circumstances?" he asked. "It grieves me to state that I do. Mr. Lionel Dacre was penniless on the night of the dinner." "Oh, don't exaggerate, Monsieur Valmont," cried Dacre with a gesture of pathetic protest. "His pocket held 1 sixpence, 2 pennies, and a halfpenny. How came you to suspect he was penniless?" "I knew he ordered a case of champagne from the London representative of Camel O'Frere, and was refused unless he paid the money down." "Quite right. And then when you were talking to Hopper, you saw that case of champagne delivered." "Excellent, excellent, Monsieur Valmont. But will a man steal, think you, even to supply himself with so delicious a wine as this we have been tasting? By the way, forgive my neglect. Allow me to fill your glass, Monsieur Valmont. Not another drop, if you will excuse me, Mr. Dacre. Ah, yes, champagne should not be mixed with evidence. When we have finished, perhaps. What further proof have you discovered, Monsieur?" "I hold proof that Mr. Dacre was threatened with bankruptcy, if on the 24th, he did not pay a bill of £78 that had been long outstanding. I hold proof that this was paid, not on the 24th, but on the 26th. Mr. Dacre had gone to the solicitor and assured him he would pay the money on that date, whereupon he was given 2 days' grace." "Ah, well, he was entitled to 3, you know, in law." "Yes, there, Monsieur Valmont, you touch the fatal point. The threat of bankruptcy will drive a man in Dacre's position to almost any crime. Bankruptcy to a barrister means ruin. It means a career blighted. It means a life buried with little chance of resurrection." "I see you grasp the supreme importance of that bit of evidence.
The case of champagne is as nothing compared with it, and this reminds me that in the crisis now upon us I shall take another sip with your permission. Sure you won't join me?
Not at this juncture, Mr. Dacre.
I envy your moderation. Here's to the success of our search, Monsieur Valmont.
I felt sorry for the gay young fellow, as with smiling face he drank the champagne.
Now, monsieur, he went on, I am amazed to learn how much you have discovered. Really, I think tradespeople, solicitors, and all such should keep better guard on their tongues than they do. Nevertheless, these documents at my elbow, which I expected would surprise you, are merely the letters and receipts. Here is the communication from the solicitor threatening me with bankruptcy. Here is his receipt dated the 26th. Here is the refusal of the wine merchant, and here is his receipt for the money. Here are smaller bills liquidated. With my pencil we will add them up. £78, the principal debt, bulks large. We add the smaller items, and it reaches a total of £93.7.4. Let us now examine my purse. Here is a £5 note. There is a golden sovereign. I now count out and place on the table 12 and 6 pence in silver and 2 pence in coppers. The purse thus becomes empty. Let us add the silver and copper to the amount on the paper. Do my eyes deceive me, or is the sum exactly £100? There is your money fully accounted for.
Pardon me, Mr. Dacre, I said, but I observe a sovereign resting on the mantelpiece.
Dacre threw back his head and laughed with greater heartiness than I had yet known him to indulge in during our short acquaintance. By Jove, he cried, you've got me there. I'd forgotten entirely about that pound on the mantelpiece, which belongs to you.
To me? Impossible.
It does, and cannot interfere in the least with our century calculation. That is the sovereign you gave to my man Hopper, who, knowing me to be hard-pressed, took it and shamefacedly presented it to me, that I may enjoy the spending of it. Hopper belongs to our family, or the family belongs to him, I am never sure which. You must have missed in him the deferential bearing of a manservant in Paris, yet he is true gold, like the sovereign you bestowed upon him, and he bestowed upon me. Now here, monsieur, is the evidence of the theft, together with the rubber band and 2 pieces of cardboard. Ask my friend Gibbs to examine them minutely. They are all at your disposition, monsieur, and thus you learn how much easier it is to deal with the master than with the servant. All the gold you possess would not have wrung these incriminating documents from old Hopper. I was compelled to send him away to the West End an hour ago, fearing that in his brutal British way he might assault you if he got an inkling of your mission.
Mr. Dacre, said I slowly, you have thoroughly convinced me.
I thought I would, he interrupted with a laugh, that you did not take the money.
Oh-ho, this is a change of wind, surely.
Many a man has been hanged on a chain of circumstantial evidence much weaker than this which I have exhibited to you. Don't you see the subtlety of my action? 99 persons in 100 would say, no man could be such a fool as to put Valmont on his own track and then place in Valmont's hands such striking evidence. But there comes in my craftiness. Of course, the rock you run up against will be Gibbs's incredulity. The first question he will ask you may be this: why did not Dacre come and borrow the money from me? Now there you find a certain weakness in your chain of evidence. I knew perfectly well that Gibbs would lend me the money, and he knew perfectly well that if I were pressed to the wall I should ask him.
Mr. Dacre, said I, you have been playing with me. I should resent that with most men, but whether it is your own genial manner, or the effect of this excellent champagne, or both together, I forgive you. But I am convinced of another thing. You know who took the money.
I don't know, but I suspect.
Will you tell me whom you suspect?
That would not be fair, but I shall now take the liberty of filling your glass with champagne.
I am your guest, Mr. Dacre.
Admirably answered, monsieur, he replied, pouring out the wine,
And now I offer you a clue. Find out all about the story of the silver spoons.
The story of the silver spoons? What silver spoons?
Ah, that is the point. Step out of the temple into Fleet Street, seize the first man you meet by the shoulder, and ask him to tell you about the silver spoons. There are but two men and two spoons concerned. When you learn who those two men are, you will know that one of them did not take the money, and I give you my assurance that the other did.
You speak in mystery, Mr. Dacre.
But certainly, for I am speaking to Monsieur Eugène Valmont.
I echo your words, sir. Admirably answered.
You put me on my mettle, and I flatter myself that I see your kindly drift. You wish me to solve the mystery of this stolen money.
Sir, you do me honour, and I drink to your health.
To yours, monsieur, said Lionel Dacre, and thus we drank and parted. On leaving Mr. Dacre, I took a hansom to a café in Regent Street, which is a passable imitation of similar places of refreshment in Paris. There, calling for a cup of black coffee, I sat down to think. The clue of the silver spoons. He had laughingly suggested that I should take by the shoulders the first man I met and ask him what the story of the silver spoons was. This course naturally struck me as absurd, and he doubtless intended it to seem absurd. Nevertheless, it contained a hint. I must ask somebody, and that the right person, to tell me the tale of the silver spoons. Under the influence of the black coffee, I reasoned it out in this way. On the night of the 23rd, one of the six guests there present stole £100, but Dacre had said that an actor in the silver spoon episode was the actual thief. That person, then, must have been one of Mr. Gibbs's guests at the dinner of the 23rd. Probably two of the guests were the participators in the silver spoon comedy. But be that as it may, it followed that one at least of the men around Mr. Gibbs's table knew the episode of the silver spoons. Perhaps Bentham Gibbs himself was cognizant of it. It followed, therefore, that the easiest plan was to question each of the men who partook of that dinner. Yet if only one knew about the spoons, that one must also have some idea that these spoons formed the clue which attached him to the crime of the 23rd, in which case he was little likely to divulge what he knew to an entire stranger. Of course, I might go to Dacre himself and demand the story of the silver spoons, but this would be a confession of failure on my part, and I rather dreaded Lionel Dacre's hearty laughter when I admitted that the mystery was too much for me. Besides this, I was very well aware of the young man's kindly intentions towards me. He wished me to unravel the coil myself, and so I determined not to go to him except as a last resource. I resolved to begin with Mr. Gibbs, and finishing my coffee, I got again into a hansom and drove back to the Temple. I found Bentham Gibbs in his room, and after greeting me, his first inquiry was about the case. "How are you getting on?" he asked. "I think I'm getting on fairly well," I replied, "and expect to finish in a day or two, if you will kindly tell me the story of the silver spoons."
"The silver spoons?" he echoed, quite evidently not understanding me.
There happened an incident in which two men were engaged, and this incident related to a pair of silver spoons. I want to get the particulars of that."
"I haven't the faintest idea what you are talking about," replied Gibbs, thoroughly bewildered.
"You will need to be more definite, I fear, if you are to get any help from me."
"I cannot be more definite, because I have already told you all I know."
"What bearing has all this on our own case?"
"I was informed that if I got hold of the clue of the silver spoons, I should be in a fair way of settling our case."
"Who told you that?"
"Mr. Lionel Dacre."
"Oh, does Dacre refer to his own conjuring?"
"I don't know, I'm sure. What was his conjuring?"
"A very clever trick he did one night at dinner here about 2 months ago."
"Had it anything to do with silver spoons?"
"Well, it was silver spoons or silver forks or something of that kind. I had entirely forgotten the incident."
So far as I recollect at the moment, there was a sleight-of-hand man with great expertness in one of the music halls, and the talk turned upon him. Then Dacre said the tricks he did were easy, and holding up a spoon or a fork, I don't remember which, he professed his ability to make it disappear before our eyes, to be found afterwards in the clothing of someone there present. Several offered to bet that he could do nothing of the kind, but he said he would bet with no one but Innes, who sat opposite him. Innes, with some reluctance, accepted the bet, and then Dacre, with a great show of the usual conjurer's gesticulations, spread forth his empty hands and said we should find the spoon in Innes's pocket. And there, sure enough, it was. It seemed a proper sleight-of-hand trick, but we were never able to get him to repeat it. Thank you very much, Mr. Gibbs. I think I see daylight now. If you do, you are cleverer than I by a long chalk, cried Bentham Gibbs as I took my departure. I went directly downstairs and knocked at Mr. Dacre's door once more. He opened the door himself, his man not yet having returned. Ah, monsieur, he cried, back already. You don't mean to tell me you have so soon got to the bottom of the silver spoon entanglement? I think I have, Mr. Dacre. You were sitting at dinner opposite Mr. Vincent Innes. You saw him conceal a silver spoon in his pocket. You probably waited for some time to understand what he meant by this, and as he did not return the spoon to its place, you proposed a conjuring trick, made the bet with him, and thus the spoon was returned to the table. Excellent, excellent, monsieur. That is very nearly what occurred, except that I acted at once. I had had experiences with Mr. Vincent Innes before. Never did he enter these rooms of mine without my missing some little trinket after he was gone. Although Mr. Innes is a very rich person, I am not a man of many possessions, so if anything is taken, I meet little difficulty in coming to a knowledge of my loss. Of course, I never mentioned these abstractions to him. They were all trivial, as I have said, and so far as the silver spoon was concerned, it was of no great value either. But I thought the bet and the recovery of the spoon would teach him a lesson. It apparently has not done so. On the night of the 23rd, he sat at my right hand, as you will see by consulting your diagram of the table and the guests. I asked him a question twice, to which he did not reply, and looking at him, I was startled by the expression in his eyes. They were fixed on a distant corner of the room, and following his gaze, I saw what he was staring at with such hypnotizing concentration. So absorbed was he in contemplation of the packet there so plainly exposed, now my attention was turned to it, that he seemed to be entirely oblivious of what was going on around him. I roused him from his trance by jocularly calling Gibbs' attention to the display of money. I expected in this way to save Innes from committing the act, which he seemingly did commit. Imagine then the dilemma in which I was placed when Gibbs confided to me the morning after what had occurred the night before. I was positive Innes had taken the money, yet I possessed no proof of it. I could not tell Gibbs, and I dare not speak to Innes. Of course, monsieur, you do not need to be told that Innes is not a thief in the ordinary sense of the word. He has no need to steal, and yet apparently cannot help doing so. I am sure that no attempt has been made to pass those notes. They are doubtless resting securely in his house at Kensington. He is, in fact, a kleptomaniac, or a maniac of some sort. And now, monsieur, was my hint regarding the silver spoons of any value to you? Of the most infinite value, Mr. Dacre. Then let me make another suggestion. I leave it entirely to your bravery, a bravery which, I confess, I do not myself possess. Will you take a hansom, drive to Mr. Innes's house on the Cromwell Road, confront him quietly and ask for the return of the packet? I am anxious to know what will happen. If he hands it to you, as I expect he will, then you must tell Mr. Gibbs the whole story. Mr. Dacre, your suggestion shall be immediately acted upon, and I thank you for your compliment to my courage. I found that Mr. Innes inhabited a very grand house. After a time he entered the study on the ground floor to which I had been conducted. He held my card in his hand and was looking at it with some surprise.
"I think I have not the pleasure of knowing you, Monsieur Valmont," he said courteously enough.
"No, I ventured to call on a matter of business. I was once investigator for the French government, and now am doing private detective work here in London."
"Ah, and how is that supposed to interest me?"
"There is nothing that I wish investigated."
"I did not send for you, did I?"
"No, Mr. Innes. I merely took the liberty of calling to ask you to let me have the package you took from Mr. Bentham Gibbes' frock coat pocket on the night of the 23rd.
"He wishes it returned, does he?"
"Yes." Mr. Innes calmly walked to a desk, which he unlocked and opened, displaying a veritable museum of trinkets of one sort and another. Pulling out a small drawer, he took from it the packet containing the 5 £20 notes. Apparently it had never been opened. With a smile, he handed it to me.
"You will make my apologies to Mr. Gibbes for not returning it before. Tell him I have been unusually busy of late."
"I shall not fail to do so," said I, with a bow. "Thanks so much. Good morning, Monsieur Valmont."
"Good morning, Mr. Innes."
And so I returned the packet to Mr. Bentham Gibbes, who pulled the notes from between their pasteboard protection and begged me to accept them. End of chapter 3.
The Clue of the Silver Spoons.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.